to non-selective, that is general. You can use that synonym here. Non-selective versus selective. And then under each, we've got depressants and stimulants. Notice that the selective agents are further subdivided into different categories that we'll be talking about during the remainder of the semester. But where we're starting is over in the upper left-hand corner, general depressants. Those drugs which historically we have seen with any number of activities, the activity that we're looking for depending to a great degree upon dose, that continuum from normal down to comatose and dead that includes such things as disinhibition, sedation, hypnosis, anesthesia that I showed you on Monday. So these are the agents that we're going to be talking about for the next week or so. With the caveat that I'm going to slip in local anesthetics here as part of the discussion as well. So this is where we are, general depressants. And as you remember, I noted it was as part of the beginning of the discussion on general anesthetics as an example of these general depressants that anesthetics, while we try to get to stage 3, plane 3 for most of our surgical anesthesia, down in here, we have to go through all of these stops, these stations on the way down that we talked about, the idea of delirium and disinhibition and sedation and hypnosis, until we get down to anesthesia. And for a long time, anesthetics first being popularized probably in the 1870s, and it wasn't until probably until the 60s and the early 70s that we did not see charts like this in emergency rooms dealing with reflexes and other things that we could utilize to determine where we were in this continuum of depression. Basically, so that we did not overshoot stage 3, plane 3, and go all the way to stage 4, plane undertaker. Okay? So, that's what these were all about. You remember I said that the biggest issue with these, this one being for ether, was that these could be modified by a number of pre-anesthetic medications. So I'm going to start this morning by talking about two questions, the first of them being, well, if we can't use this because of all the problems associated with it, what then do we use now from the 1960s on? Well, three things basically, and I've listed them in your handout. Okay, one, and probably the most widely used, probably the most accurate, I don't know what's the word I want to use, but I guess I will. Of the three is what we call MAC value. That does not stand for Mid-American Conference in this instance. The MAC stands for the minimum alveolar concentration. And so you'll notice I'm on Roman numeral 2C. How do we monitor a level of anesthesia? By the MAC. We've got the ability now and have had for probably 30, 40 years with our system of administration to monitor levels in the inspired versus the expired air. And from those measurements, we can determine how much is in the alveoli. A MAC value, minimum alveolar concentration, says how much do we need in the alveoli to get this person anesthetized. and keep them anesthetized. We know those values, and we can now measure them fairly accurately. Okay? So the anesthetic concentration, not only going in, but coming out of it in expired air, can be utilized to determine the depth of anesthesia. In addition to that, autonomic parameters, particularly heart rate and blood pressure, are commonly utilized now. And as I'll talk about when we get to the individual compounds, there are some shades of difference here. So the anesthetist has to be pretty much aware of the compound he or she is using in order to be able to utilize these. Okay? But autonomics. And then finally, not so commonly used because of the trouble to get it all together, putting all the electrodes on and that. Sometimes, particularly in delicate types of situations, often if the surgery is cranial in nature, we will utilize EEG, an electroencephalogram, as part of our monitoring of where we are in terms of anesthetic concentration. So while that chart by Goodell for ether used to be fairly common in surgical suites, now more often what we see is a listing of various of these anesthetics and what a MAC value should be in various situations and that sort of thing. So that's what we utilize. Now the next question is, my statement that this type of thing could be modified so much by pre-anesthetic medications. Well, that begs the question, why do you need a pre-anesthetic medication? What's it all about? Well, let me start by saying this. Why do we have 15 volatile anesthetics? The answer? Because none of them are perfect. They all have issues of one sort or another. And because they have issues, we commonly have utilized other medications to try and get around these issues. Okay? I'm going to use ether as a prototype example. Ether has issues. And that's why we started looking for newer, better compounds. We still are working. We've got compounds that don't have as many issues as ether, but they still have issues. What kind of issues, you may ask? Well, things like if we are doing surgery, okay, we would like for the muscles, that is the voluntary muscles, to be as relaxed as possible. That is, most abdominal or thoracic surgery, as well as most orthopedic surgery, is done with what we call blunt dissection. That is, we aren't in a MASH unit. This isn't like Hawkeye or Zorro with a sword or a scalpel. It's not slash and burn surgery. We gently separate overlying musculature to try minimal damage. And it is much easier to separate that musculature if it is relaxed rather than tense. Now, why would it be tense? Well, it's surgery, goddammit. People are upset, they're nervous, they're anxious. Which leads me to another point. If they're anxious, what should we try and do? Relieve their anxiety. They might be in pain. It would be nice to alleviate some of that pain before the surgery. Okay, so muscle relaxants used, anxiolytics used, pain relievers used, and these can modify the signs and symptoms of these various viable anesthetics. Okay? Another thing that common with ether, some of the newer anesthetics don't do it as much. Some of them do. We'll talk about that. Is that we are inhaling them. They are gas. We are using all of that alveolar surface. They are irritating to bronchial tissues as they go in and out. So secretions can be an issue. Bronchospasm can be an issue. And we would utilize compounds to try and minimize this as well. Things like antimuscarinics, you remember those? Dry people up, causing relaxation in the bronchioles. Okay. So you see scopolamine listed there as a possibility because of its sedative CNS effects and because it's antimuscarinic to block secretion. So I've listed a few possibilities there as were pre-anesthetic meds and what they can be utilized for. So from that then, let's get on with it. Gases to begin with. And the first gas utilized, as you remember, and sometimes still utilized, NO, nitrous oxide. Colorless gas, it's more dense than air, tends to settle toward the floor. When we utilize it these days commercially, we put it under pressure as a liquid, you know, a lot like propane that we utilize for heat. We don't have a big room full of gaseous propane, we compress it into liquid propane, put it in a low tank. Same thing with nitrous oxide, liquefy it by pressure, okay? But it is a gas, even at room temperature. All right, point number one. The oxygen of nitrous oxide will not support respiration. Now, as you're sitting there breathing the air in this room, how much of it is in round terms, oxygen? How much? About what?
20.
20. Okay. Most of the rest, the other 80, is almost all nitrogen. Okay. Alright. Nitrous oxide will not support respiration. So what's the most nitrous oxide you should have in an inspiratory mix? Probably 80, maybe you can get away with 85%, because the rest has got to be. 80% nitrous oxide will get you somewhere between stage 2 and stage 3. Past delirium, but not much. All right? 10 to 35% gets you fairly good analgesia. Doesn't knock you out, gives you pretty good analgesia. So for quite a while, and maybe in certain areas, we will still see nitrous oxide utilized in an obstetrics situation for pain relief. There are other issues with that, but every once in a while you still see it used. Okay? It's used because it's not muscle relaxant. It's not going to work against labor. at least directly, might make the mother a little silly so that she doesn't respond to direction as well as she should, but directly it's not going to impugn her contractility. Good analgesic. But back to the point, 80% will not get you to surgical anesthesia levels. For a long time, we used 100% nitrous oxide. And people went to sleep. They did get kind of comatose. Why? The word, if you care to try and spell it, is asphyxiation. Okay? So, while nitrous oxide is still used, sometimes in labor, often if a person is really gun-shy from a needle and local anesthesia, maybe some in here, how many of you know what a dentist is? Have you gone to a dentist? How many use nitrous oxide as their analgesic of choice in a dental chair? About a few? Okay. You know, when that rifle barrel comes down toward your mouth. Okay. All right. Now, some other things about nitrous oxide. It's a myocardial depressant. It's a negative inotrope, and it's directly negative inotrope. It decreases cardiac output. Okay? And I say that because if it decreases cardiac output, what would you think might happen to your blood pressure? Goes down, maybe, now wait a second, don't go there yet. It tries to go down, but immediately what kicks in? Reflex. Reflex what? The baroreceptors? Yeah, but we get reflex tachycardia. In addition, okay, it is somewhat of a cardiac stimulant directly because of sympathetic activation centrally. So we've got a direct myocardial depressant working against a centrally mediated, first of all, reflex, and second, direct sympathetic response. Kind of a tug of war, a teeter-totter. Nitrous oxide needs to be used very, very cautiously in cardiac patients for this reason. You can go all over the map with cardiac response to this compound, particularly at higher doses. Now, that's not trying to scare you out of the dentist chair. But again, if there's pre-existing cardiac pathology, be careful. Okay? But the other big thing about nitrous oxide and where I want to use this. Doc, have you heard of general anesthesia yet from the med chemist? Yes? No? Hello? Remember what they look like? Okay. Dr. Boncher, physical chemistry at its best, so she lays into this pretty heavy. I'm just going to briefly go through it, okay? There are a number of things that we looked at initially as to how anesthesia comes about. This is a little aside at this point, I guess. How anesthesia comes about. The reason for that inquiry is because of the wide variety of chemical structures that can cause anesthesia. And the thinking was, there is no one receptor that can interact with this wide variety of chemicals. So we developed what were known as non-specific theories of drug action versus the specific theories that I talked about in the intro course. Things like rate theory and molecular perturbation and all this kind of specific theory jazz. We had non-specific theories basically to try and talk about general anesthesia. We thought it was a physical chemical type of thing, that it was a solubility thing, that these drugs were solubilizing in neuron cell membrane and somehow disrupting and that kind of stuff. Physical chemical. And so we looked at a lot of different physical chemical attributes, and out of all of those, the one that really stood out was the lambda value, Greek letter lambda. And lambda stands for blood gas partition coefficient. That is, what is the ratio after it goes through the alveoli into the blood? What is the ratio of that anesthetic that's there solubilized in the blood versus that is free gas? Because we discovered very quickly that if it's solubilized in the blood, it keeps getting across the blood-brain barrier. It's the free gas that's going to do the dirty work, get across the BBB, and work on the central nervous system neurons. So the higher the lambda value, the more it's soluble in blood, the less free gas. The slower it's going to be in terms of onset, because there's not a whole lot of free gas to get across the blood-brain barrier compared to the amount of gas that's being inhaled, because it's solubilizing in blood. Are you with me so far? Okay. Here are three compounds we're going to talk about. Nitrous oxide, halothane, methoxyfluorine. I'm just going to dwell on nitrous oxide at this point. Notice that in terms of time and in terms of arterial anesthetic concentration as a percentage of that that's being inhaled, nitrous oxide goes up rather quickly. It has a fairly quick onset of action. It is not very soluble in the blood. Its lambda value is 0.47, or 0.48, or somewhere in there. It's less than 1. So the gas that is inhaled is gas in the blood, gets across and is gas in the CNS pretty quick. Okay? Low lambda value, as opposed to something like methoxyfluorine, whose lambda value I think is in the neighborhood of 14 to 15. Very soluble in the blood, that leaves less percentage of free gas in the blood to get across the blood-brain barrier. Its onset of action, very, very slow. Diethyl ether's lambda value, I think, is around 12. Okay? And so, it also tends to be fairly low. By the way, before you get too upset, this should be in your handout somewhere. And you'll notice the lambda values on the left-hand side. Okay. But here I'm talking about nitrous oxide. So we've got all this gas in the blood. Now you notice the term I've got up here. Another problem with nitrous oxide, particularly if you're trying to use it as an anesthetic, that is you've got a max. You're at 80-85% gas. And now you take the mask away and let the person inspire in. Already said, air is what? 20% oxygen, 80% nitrogen. You take an inspiration. And now in your alveoli, you've got 80% nitrogen, 20% oxygen. But what you've also got is all of this free nitrous oxide rushing back across the alveolar membrane. After you've removed the mask, where is all of the concentration? Where is the higher part of the partition gradient? The bloodstream comes back across the alveolar membrane, and now instead of 80-20, you've got maybe, what, 60-30-10? Nitrogen, not as much. Oxygen, not as much, because a big percentage now of what's in the alveoli is going to be nitrous oxide as it comes rushing back out of the blood. The condition is known as diffusion hypoxia, and it's something to be watched for in anesthetics with very low lambda values. And in fact, until we knew what we were doing, we killed a few people with this. They asphyxiated because we didn't know enough to give them pure oxygen for a few minutes after we took the nitrous oxide away. So we killed some with asphyxiation going in. We killed a few with asphyxiation coming back out. Nitrous oxide, a gas that's used mainly now for its analgesic qualities. We'll talk in a day or so about it also being used in various anesthetic combinations because of its ability in terms of onset. Very quick onset because of a lot of free gas going across the blood-brain barrier fairly quickly. And it was used for onset quite a bit until we started looking at IV onset types of materials. Okay. Nitrous oxide. A couple of other gases I just wanted to mention. More for historical purposes than to talk about a couple of problems. Gas called ethylene. Now remember, historically, what was the anesthetic, the volatile liquid that Morton used that became the prototype for Dama compound for 100 years? It was diethyl ether. So it's not surprising that we'll start seeing a lot of compounds with ethyl groups around. We'll also start seeing a lot of compounds with ether linkages around. Ethylene, a gas. Okay. Noticed in 1908 that it caused flowers to close up. It anesthetized them, they said. So if it's good enough for flowers, it's good enough for for humans. So we tried it. Ethylene is described as having a rotten garlic odor. Now, I'm not that big as a food connoisseur, so I don't know good garlic from rotten garlic in terms of odor. I don't like garlic, period, so you'll have to help me there. But it's described as having rotten garlic odor. And it was used as a volatile or as a gas anesthetic for about 30 years. It has a lot of good points, but it has one very bad point. It is violently explosive. And particularly, it gets set off by sparks from electric issues. So if a machine starts up in the room, bam. So we had to make surgical suites isoelectric. So you didn't walk into a surgical suite with tennis shoes like I've got, rub your feet across the floor, and then try and spark the next person in the room. Okay? Isoelectric, very expensive, as you might suspect. It is ethylene, among others, that's responsible for the fact that for any number of years, surgical suites were built either on the top floor of the hospital or in a separate wing. So that when it exploded, not if, but when it exploded, it would not take the rest of the hospital down with it. Ethylene. Rapid induction, good analgesia, good muscle relaxation. It was a good compound, but yeah. Another gas, cyclopropane. Anesthetic properties first noticed in 1930. Okay. Again, the big issue with cyclopropane was its explosiveness. We could get down to surgical anesthesia in 2 to 3 minutes. There was a rapid recovery period. But the only thing besides its explosiveness that worked against it was it was highly irritating to the bronchioles. But another thing that we notice that I'm going to be talking about with other compounds as we go through them, is this becomes the prototypical compound or a problem, an issue, and that is myocardial sensitization. We'll discover with a number of the compounds that what happens is they sensitize the myocardium, they make it more sensitive to catecholamines, things like norepi and epi. And of course, if you're going to surgery and you're anxious, the adrenal medulla has kicked in, right? And so there's fairly high concentrations of epi and norepi running around. So this tends to be a problem. But it becomes a prototype for this, but it's not used after World War II much, again, because of the explosive nature of the compound. So those are some examples. One gas still utilized mainly as an analgesic and or inducing agent. The other two are no longer used because of issues. So if we don't use gases. What do we use, you ask? And I tell you again that what we do use are volatile compounds. The prototyping diethyl ether, a compound with a lambda value in the neighborhood of 12. What's the odor of ether smell like? What does ether smell like? In a word, ether. It's got a characteristic odor. It doesn't smell like perfume or roses. It smells like ether. Okay? Ether has a tendency to oxidize to peroxide, which can be explosive. To minimize this, we have to put it in iron or copper containers. It induces a generalized depression. It's a potent analgesic. It's a good muscle relaxant. 10 to 15% in the gas will give us stage 4, that is, past surgical anesthesia, so it's fairly potent. The problem is that lambda value is high. What did I say it was? So what would you guess about induction and recovery? It tends to be long, slow and labored. Neighborhood of 15, 20 minutes or better. And again, it's a negative inotrope. It is highly irritating to the bronchial tree. Lots of secretions, lots of laryngospasm. Part of the problem with using ether by itself is you get a lot of coughing. Very hard on you if you're trying to intubate. Those types of things, okay? The big issue going down, coming back up, so we tried some other compounds. One of the first, this is more historical now, is chloroform. Colorless liquid, lambda value again, somewhat high, but the only way you see it used anymore is in spy James Bond types of movies. You know, where you put a cotton over the heroine's mouth and drag her out to have your way with her from a bar, those types of things. Of course, now we have better compounds to do that. Chloroform. Get the picture, okay? What are the issues with chloroform? It sensitizes myocardial tissue, but the other thing about it, and we're going to find it in the newer compounds as well, that we'll talk about on Friday, is that it gets metabolized. And part of the metabolic scheme is free radical halogens. Leading to all sorts of liver toxicity issues. And not only direct liver toxicity, but things like liver cancer, mutagenicity, and carcinogenicity become problems. Okay? So high myocardial sensitization was not very good in cardiac blood pressure situations. And also this tendency toward issues in the liver. Okay? But it gave us an interesting idea, because chloroform is not one ethyl. Rather, it is methyl, and two, it is not ether. And so, where we're going to start on Friday is with the compound that really put Abbott Laboratories in Chicago on the map. This is the structure of halothane, fluothane, which Abbott gets on the market in the late 40s, early 50s. Ethyl. And, you know, if chlorine works, why not throw them all in the sink? Every halogen you can imagine is on this compound. It was trade named fluothane, because mostly fluorines, but the generic is halothane, halogen. And it becomes the prototype for all of them, not all of them, the majority of compounds of volatile liquid nature that have developed as general anesthetics since about 1950. We'll talk about advantages and disadvantages as we come to this on Friday, but I just want to say, yes, it sensitizes myocardial tissue. Yes, there are halogens, so we have liver issues. Halothane hepatitis becomes a big problem. One of the downers, if you will. Okay? Now, what I want to end this morning with is this. I've been approached by more than one individual from the class suggesting that I move the next exam from Monday the 9th back to Friday the 6th. The reason being that apparently there are a couple of other exams during the week of Monday the 9th. Okay, now if that is an issue for you because maybe you've got an elective that has an exam on that Friday or something else of that nature, either email me, slip me some hate mail under my door, let your voice be heard, let's see how much upset it is. If it's minimal, I can deal with it and we'll move it. If it's not minimal, I'm going to leave it on Monday the 9th. So at least let's look at that as an alternative, okay? So in the next 48 hours, try and show me your displeasure if indeed you do move it. Because I will want to move it by Friday or Monday at the latest.